We are up to number 7. We've been moving along, and in our last discussion, which was last week, we explored the concept of nevuah as the Rambam describes it, and the principle of nevuah and prophecy. We spent a couple of weeks actually discussing that. We looked at it from several perspectives. Number one, the notion that the Rambam introduces prophecy into the 13 principles of faith, and he does so immediately following idolatry. He does so separately from the concept of the nevuah of Moshe, or the status of Moshe per se. That's number 7. And so we looked at nevuah as a concept by in and of itself. What role does the notion of prophecy play in the broader canvas of philosophy for the Rambam? Time permitting, if not this week, then one of our future sessions, I'll show you the Kuzari. The Kuzari has a somewhat different take on the distinction between prophecy in general and the prophecy of Moshe in particular. For now, we're going to work with the Rambam. So the Rambam goes from idolatry and prophecy, and the thesis that I tried to express last week was that the two are actually interrelated. They are opposite ends of the same process. The notion of a need or an attempt to be close to God, to have a tangible relationship with God, to connect to God in a very real way. The channeled properly, it leads to the highest type of spiritual attainment, namely prophecy. Channeled incorrectly, it leads to the depths of idolatry. And I showed you the Gemara that compares the relationship between those two in a similar way to the relationship between adultery and procreation. Both manifestations of the same physical desire, one channeled properly, the other channeled incorrectly, improperly. Based on that distinction, we suggested that nevuah and avodah zarah are actually flip sides of the same coin, namely the desire to have a relationship with God, but that we are in desperate need of a objective criteria that tells me how to direct that relationship with God in one way and not the other, to direct it towards the attainment of prophecy, or at least the closest we can get to it, rather than the attainment of idolatry. And that leads us directly to principle number 7. Of all of the principles of faith that the Rambam lays down in his commentary on the Mishnah, which is the text that we've been studying, number 7 is the longest. It's not necessarily the most complex of all the topics, but he does spend the most amount of time in text-wise, column inches, to use a journalistic term. He does spend the most amount of time and dedicate the most column inches to this discussion. We'll see why. So we're going to be here for a few days, a few sessions. We're going to work this through systematically. Starting from the beginning, you have it both in the Hebrew and, to the best of my ability, in English translation. Hayesod hashvi'i, nivu'at Moshe Rabbeinu. Seventh foundation is the prophecy of Moshe Rabbeinu, Moshe our teacher. V'hu shenamin, shehu avihen shel kol hanevi'im shekadmu lefanav v'habaim acharav. And that is to believe, to understand, or to trust, as we've translated the word emunah as trust, that Moshe is the chief of all prophets. Avihen shel kol hanevi'im. All prophets who came before him, and more importantly, all prophets who will come after him. To make that kind of a sweeping statement, you have to assume that the nature of Moshe's uniqueness is something which is unattainable by any other future prophet. Otherwise, you wouldn't be able to make a statement that says no prophet in the future will ever reach that level, because who says that somebody can't? Unless the nature of what makes Moshe unique is something which is unrepeatable by any other human being. Hakol hem lamata b'menu b'mala. All other prophets are lesser than he in their level of prophecy. V'hu b'chir Hashem mikol amina enoshi. And that makes Moshe the choicest of all of human beings. Asher hisig mimenu yit'ala yoter mima sheisig v'yasig kol adam shenimtza v'sheyimatze. Because he was able to understand and to attain a greater knowledge than any other human being ever was, or ever did, or ever will. And again, the constant reference to both past and future. V'shehu alav ha-shalom megiya letachlit ha-romimut me'al ha-enushiyut ad shehisiga ma'ala ha-malachit v'nasa b'ma'alat ha-malachim. It's as if to say that Moshe elevated himself above the level of normal human being, entered into the domain of angels. Lo nishar lefanav shum masach shelo karo v'lo atzar ba'ado shum ma'atzor gufani. There was no barrier that Moshe did not, no physical barrier that Moshe was not able to surpass. He was able to remove any flaw. He was able to reach a point of being pure, in almost pure intellect. And that's what the Torah means when it says that Moshe was able to communicate with God without any kind of angelic intermediary. I'll come back to the distinctions per se. The Rambam will explain each of these distinctions, what they mean. We'll come in more elaboration in a moment. Before we go on, let me just first understand where the Rambam takes this idea from. Rambam will elaborate on the distinctions between the Nevuah of Moshe and the Nevuah of every other Navi, but this notion that Moshe is unique and that no other prophet will ever reach his prophecy, the astoundingness of the statement that we can make with such assertion, not only was it so, but that it will always be so, that's really a remarkable declaration. Where does that come from? Could be that the Rambam made it up. It's possible. I don't think so. I think the answer lies in the very last psukim of the Torah. The very, very end of the Torah, last psukim. Very last psukim that we read them on Simchas Torah, says as follows. In the description of Moshe that the Torah gives, the end of his life, Moshe dies on there on Har Nevo. Where is Moshe buried, by the way? Right, where is Moshe? So give me the general geographic location. Where is Moshe buried?
Moab.
Where in Moab?
Across from Yericho.
Okay, specifically where? No, we haven't yet. Would you like to offer that as a possibility? Har Nevo. Oh, so that's the optical illusion. That's very interesting. Moshe is buried in Har Nevo. It's actually not true, but it's about as close as you're going to get to getting the right answer without getting the right answer. Namely, Moshe goes up to Har Nevo, and from there he sees all of Israel. He dies there on Har Nevo, but he's not buried there. Right. Because it says, Vayikbor oto bagai. He's buried in the valley. He dies on the mountain. He's buried in the valley.
Isn't there some thought that his entire body goes up to heaven? And then...
Not by Moshe. No. By Eliyahu, it says so. But not by Moshe. Moshe dies and is buried. Vayikbor oto bagai. Be'eretz Moav. And we read it as God buried him, but he died on top of the mountain. And he Vayikubor oto bagai, and he how do you translate? He buried him in the valley, in the land of Moab. No one knows his burial place. Assuming that HaKadosh Baruch Hu buried him, he would have had to take him from the mountain down to Ein Hohe. It's an interesting observation that he goes up the mountain, there he dies, but he's buried in the valley. Nonetheless, and then they cry for Moshe, they mourn for him for 30 days. Pasuk Yud. Velo kam navi od b'Yisrael kimoshe. No prophet has ever arisen like Moshe. Asher yidao Hashem panim o panim. Whom God knew face to face. And we'll come back to that phrase and what it means. L'chol ha'otot v'amavtim asher shlocho Hashem lasot be'eretz Mitzrayim l'faro l'chol ha'vadav v'l'chol ha'ratzo. Certainly in terms of the great miracles, as evidenced by the signs and the wonders that God had him do before Egypt, in before Pharaoh and all of his servants in Egypt, and all the miracles that he did in the eyes of Israel. It's interesting that the Torah places the emphasis on the miracles that Moshe achieved and accomplished. The Rambam will de-emphasize the miracles and focus more on the level of prophecy that he attained. But the Torah seems to say that Moshe, no other prophet ever arose like Moshe who knew God face to face. That is a declaration of what happened in the past. Lo kam navi kemoshe od. Lo kam od navi b'Yisrael kemoshe. No other prophet ever arose like Moshe. The Rambam has reformulated that statement not only from the past, but also in the future. No prophet ever was, nor will be. Where does the Rambam extrapolate the past into the future? Od means past tense. Lo kam navi od b'Yisrael. No other prophet has arisen in Israel. Why does that mean that there won't be in the future?
But it can also mean yet. Not yet.
But look, comes past tense.
Yet.
Okay, it means it could be in the future.
Right.
But that's not what the Rambam writes. The Rambam writes that it will never be in the future. As a matter of principle, it cannot be in the future. So my question is, where did the extrapolation go from the past to the future?
Torah will always be true.
Right. That's the assumption.
In the future, we could always say in the past.
Right. That's the logical jump that you have to make. And it's true. It's just you have to think like that. You have to remember that for this statement to always be accurate, it has to exclude any potential future prophet equal to Moshe as well. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, you could never make an articulation that in this Torah, forever and ever in eternity, we'll always be able to read a pasuk that says, never has a prophet like Moshe arisen.
Does that mean wherever it says, Ad HaYom HaZeh, all those different places?
No, actually, the Mefarshim struggle with the phrase Ad HaYom HaZeh, as to whether or not the phrase Ad HaYom HaZeh means to eternity or till the time of the authorship of that statement, because most of those expressions are in Navi. There's one or two in Chumash. But certainly in the Navi, you could argue that it's Ad HaYom HaZeh, meaning until the time of its authorship. Mm-hmm. But this doesn't even say Ad HaYom HaZeh. This is much more definitive. No prophet has ever arisen like Moshe. V'lo kam navi od b'Yisrael k'moshe. And of course, that's how we formulate this principle in the Yigdal. Hmm. Right? Lo kam b'Yisrael k'moshe od navi umabit Tumunato. No other prophet. No kam b'Yisrael k'moshe od navi umabit tumunato. No other prophet. No other. Never has arisen in Israel another person who is both a navi and somebody who can look at God umabit tumunato. So that's the source of this idea. That the Torah itself, in its closing words, its closing remarks, negates any possibility of any future prophet equaling Moshe. So the obvious question that then has to be addressed is, in what way is Moshe different from every other prophet? And that can be defined in a number of different possible ways. You could argue that Moshe's distinction is in the quantity of his prophecy. You could argue that his distinction is in the quality of his prophecy. You could argue that his distinction is in the purpose of his prophecy. And we will essentially try to merge all of that together into one.
The fact that he was face to face with God.
Well, so that's one of the characteristics the Rambam is going to talk about.
Probably.
In other words, the Rambam is going to address the qualitative nature of Moshe's prophecy. In what way does the mechanism of Moshe's prophecy differ from every other prophet? Also based on Psukim in the Torah. We are going to have to take it beyond just the qualitative level of the prophecy and ask the question of why. Why was it? Why did Moshe attain such a level? And if Moshe could have attained such a level, then why can't anybody else? To assert that Moshe is qualitatively different than all the other Nevi'im doesn't negate the possibility of somebody else attaining that same qualitative edge. The best records are meant to be broken. So if somebody breaks the record in Nevuah, he challenges everybody else to break the same record. So just because somebody reaches the plateau of being a better Navi than any other Navi doesn't necessarily mean, ipso facto, that no other person in human history, past or future, will ever be able to break that record. So there has to be something else going on beyond the qualitative edge that Moshe attains. That's a question we will have to address. We're not going to get there tonight. But that's a question we have to keep in the back of our minds. What is it, what is going on here that gives Moshe this unique status and solidifies that status, makes that status permanent. Must be a verb there somewhere. It makes that status permanent to the point where nobody else can ever reach that level, even if they went through the same process that supposedly Moshe went through himself.
Generation, and it was in his generation that Yud Hey Vav Hey was introduced, which was 26. And it's sort of
that may be true, but it's far too esoteric and far too Kabbalistic to have legal ramification. The Rambam is talking in legalistic terms. Understand how legalistic these terms are. This principle, more than any other principle in all 13, is the source of the greatest challenges to Judaism theologically and historically. Every religious system that has ever come about as an offshoot or a challenge to Judaism has tried to challenge this principle. Christianity certainly challenged this principle. Islam certainly challenged this principle. In historical terms, we have faced more challenges, even within our own people, segments and groups within the Jewish world who have challenged this principle with enormous ramifications. If you undo this principle, you undo the tapestry that holds the totality of the halachic system in place. There is nothing more profound, more important, more, to borrow the term, fundamental to the structure of Jewish life, halachic life as we understand it, than this principle. So to base it on the esoteric or Kabbalistic notions is too weak a foundation, in my opinion, for it to be the motivation here. It could be true, but I don't think that that would necessarily answer our question of why it is so. We need to establish the fact that Moshe's position is immutable, and to do so with enough certainty that no historic movement can budge and can move that foundation. That was a very got a little bit too philosophical. Do you understand what my point is? This is it. This is the core. This is where it's all about. It starts here and it ends here in terms of practical halachic rabbinic Judaism as understood through the Masoret of the rabbis and the Torah Shebaal Peh.
Isn't Moshe the only prophet that God speaks face to face?
Well, we're going to get to the differences. We haven't discussed the differences. So that's what he's going to get to next. But the first thing he's established is that whatever these differences are, they are unrepeatable. And that's the key piece. They are unrepeatable. No other prophet in the history of human being, in the history of Jewish life, or any civilization can ever claim to undo the prophecy of Moshe, because no other prophet can reach the qualitative level that Moshe reached. You understand? I don't need to spell out where Judaism and Christianity differed so profoundly on this principle. This is where it is at its core. Sidebar, open parentheses, says the Rambam. Right in the middle of this paragraph, in the Hebrew and the English, it's a new paragraph. V'ratziti leve'er kan zeh ha'inyan ha'nifla. I wanted to explain this wondrous topic. Ve'eferesh stumot psukei Torah, I wanted to open the sealed verses of the Torah, ve'ever inyan omro pel peh, I wanted to explain the phrase of what it means when God says, I spoke to Moshe mouth to mouth. What does that mean? God doesn't have a mouth, so it can't mean literally. V'chol ha'pasuk hazeh v'zulatom, and you know, and this pasuk and many others like it, but I saw that these are very nuanced ideas. And in order to explain them properly, we need to have many introductions and many parables. I first have to explain to you what an angel is and what the angels are all about, and how the angels differ from the created beings. I have to explain to you what a soul is and how the soul operates and all of the matters relating to the soul and the spirit of the human being. And then this notion, this ability to explain prophecy in all of its facets, and specifically the Moshe's prophecy, would be so large, I'd have to explain every image that the prophets ever used to describe God, and this wouldn't itself be insufficient. Even if I were to be very concise as I possibly could be, this would take minimally 100 pages. I'm not sure what a folio was for the Rambam. A piece of parchment? What's a page in the Rambam? But all right. Therefore, I will leave that topic for now, and I will not address it. I will address it some other time, or maybe I'll include it in a separate work that I have intent to write, which is a complete explanation of all of the Midrashei Chazal, all of the parables that Chazal use in their explanation of the Torah, or maybe I'll include it in a book on prophecy, which I've begun to write, or maybe I'll include it in a book that I'm planning to write on, which would be an elaboration on these 13 principles. I've got lots to write. So, Mirtz Hashem, I'll include it somewhere along the line. Please remember that the Rambam is 23 years old. Rabbi writes the Parashat Mishnayos when he's 23 years old. And unfortunately for us, most all of these books that he describes here that he had intended to write at the age of 23, he never wrote. So we have this reference, this amazing reference to the library in his mind of what he wanted to write, a book on Medrash, and a book on Nevuah, and a book on the 13 Principles of Faith, and a book on the Nevuah of Moshe, and he never wrote any of them. The closest he ever got was the Mor Nevuchim, in which he includes some of the ideas, but certainly not the kind of elaboration that he had intended or describes here. And we are left with the gaping hole of wanting to know more and learn more, and unfortunately, time was too short, and he was unable to do so. It's an amazing paragraph. It's the only paragraph like it in the whole treatise of the 13 Principles, where he digresses, and he's talking to you like a reader, not as an instructor and a philosopher, but just as you're reading this, he says, well, you know what? This is what I wanted to do. I wanted to write this and that and the other, and I'll get to it eventually. And now I'll go back to my subject. And, you know, unfortunately, he never goes beyond what he wrote here. Let's go back now to my primary subject, which is this seventh foundation, and I will explain it. Shenivuat Moshe Rabbeinu nivdala minivuat kol shaar ha-neviim ba-arba'a hevdili. What makes Moshe's nevuah different is primarily four distinctions. Now, to understand these four distinctions, we need to learn five psukim in Chumash. So can I trouble somebody to just, maybe somebody can just grab a couple of Chumashim and distribute them, and let's learn a couple of psukim together. The psukim to which I refer, of course, are the psukim at the end of Parashat Beha'alotcha. Bamidbar, chapter 12, page 794. The story here, which is well known, the story of Miriam and her momentary lapse of Lashon Hara that she speaks about Moshe. And there it says, Vatadaber, beginning of chapter 12, Vatadaber Miriam v'Aaron b'Moshe al odot ha'isha kushit asher lakach. Miriam spoke to Aaron about Moshe in regards to the story of the Cushite woman whom he had married. Kisha Kushit Lakach, for he married a Kushite woman. Who this Kushite woman is a matter of great discussion and debate amongst the commentaries, with various opinions ranging from Tzipora to another wife that he took in addition to Tzipora to many other opinions in between. That is not the topic of our discussion. What she said was, Harak ach bim Moshe diber Hashem. Did God only speak to Moshe? Halokam banu diber. God spoke to us too. In other words, whatever her issue is, she is upset, and her state or her complaint includes the declaration. The rest of the complaint is not relevant, and therefore the Torah doesn't include it. But the primary part that's relevant is the fact that she compares her nevuah, or her status as a Navi, Miriam HaNeviya. Don't forget that she is called Miriam HaNeviya. When she went out to Shirat HaYam, when she took the woman out to dance, it says Miriam HaNeviya. So she certainly has the status of being a Navi. Aaron certainly has the status of being a Navi. And God spoke to Aaron many times. And she says, we also spoke to God. Whatever the context for that complaint was, in that moment, she compares herself and Aaron to Moshe. Vayishma Hashem. God heard, and he wasn't happy. Moshe was the most humble of any human being. That statement is there as a parenthetical comment, almost like an editorial comment. Namely, what's the purpose of telling us here that Moshe was the most humble of all human beings?
Miriam was not.
She was not being
humble. Well, number one, that she was not being humble, but number two, well, that's the irony of it, that Moshe is forced to write that statement. This story I've certainly told you because I remember telling it from the pulpit more than once. But my favorite story in all of Shas is a little vignette at the end of the Gemara in Sota, where they're discussing various character traits and how different personalities of the rabbis represented the epitome of that character trait. And when they died, in a certain sense, that character trait died with them. So the Gemara says, when so-and-so died, chesed died with them. And when so-and-so died, whatever the trait under discussion is. And then the Gemara says, Mishemet Rebbe batla anava min ha'olam. When Rebbe died, and Rebbe was an enormously wealthy individual, the Gemara says, when Rebbe died, humility died with him. Rebbe's humility is an amazing story because he is single-handedly credited with the redaction of the Mishnah. Now, the Mishnah is an articulation of many, many opinions on every topic in Jewish law. And Rebbe, who was himself a Tana and the head of the Sanhedrin and a great Talmud Chacham and really the leader of his generation, also had opinions on every matter of Jewish law. And with almost rare exception, the Mishnah never tells us what Rebbe's opinion is. It's always the job of the Gemara to quote the Braita, which is non-Mishnaic material, that includes the opinion of Rebbe. Because with almost no exception, or a few, Rebbe never included his own opinion in the Mishnah. It's a remarkable process for somebody who is redacting and editing the entire Mishnah. When Rebbe dies, says the Gemara, and an individual who was, without question, the most wealthy individual of his generation, humility dies with him. Immediately the Gemara says, Kam Rabbi Yossi v'amar. Rabbi Yossi stood up in that discussion, and when one sage said, when Rebbe died, humility died with him. Another sage by the name of Rabbi Yossi stood up and said, Al titne anova, you can't say that when Rebbe died, humility died with him. And they looked at him and he said, why not? And he said, V'ha'ika ana, what about me? And you have to stop and think. You know, rabbis had a sense of humor. But what it tells us a great deal about the Jewish concept of humility and what it means and what it doesn't mean. But that notwithstanding, when Moshe is forced to write that Moshe is the most humble of every human being, it always reminds me of that story, because humility in the Jewish, in the Torah perspective, is not self-negation. Self-negation is a separate concept. Humility is the notion of a recognition that whatever character, whatever strengths one has, is a gift from the Ribono Shel Olam, and credit goes to God. But it doesn't mean to deny or not to recognize the strengths that one has. So Moshe understood what his role was, and more than once Moshe defended his role and was forced to defend his role. It is not true that humility can be compared, is analogous to meekness. Moshe was humble, he was not meek. And you only need to read the story of Korach and the rebellion of Korach to understand how strong Moshe was when he needed to be. So that's the irony of this verse, that it's Moshe writing it, but not because Moshe wants to write it, but because God says, that's what you write. Be that as it may, back to the story. Vayomer Hashem pit'om el Moshe ve'el Aaron ve'el Miriam. God comes to all three of them, suddenly, unannounced. Moshe, Aaron, and Miriam, unannounced. And says to them, Tzud shloshtechem elo amoed, the three of you go and meet. at the Mishkan, at the Omoed. V'yetzu shloshtam, and they all three meet there. V'yered Hashem b'amud anam v'yamod petach ha'ol. God comes to them in the cloud of that hovered over the tent. V'yikra Aaron u'Miriam v'yetzu shnehem, and he called to Aaron and Miriam. Separates Aaron and Miriam from Moshe. V'yomer, and he says to Aaron and Miriam, Shimun advarai, you listen to me now. You listen to me. Im yenevi'achem Hashem, if you were to have a prophet of God, any other prophet, b'mareh elav et vada b'chalom adabebo, I would appear to him, or her, in some kind of a vision, or in a dream. Lochen avdi Moshe, not so with my servant Moshe. V'chol beiti ne'eman hu, he is the most trusted. Back to our discussion about the word emunah. The most trusted in all my household. Pe el pe adaber bo. I speak to him. Pe el pe. Whatever pe el pe means, the Rambam said he was going to spend 100 pages explaining what pe el pe means, but whatever it means, I speak to him pe el pe, mouth to mouth. Umare v'lo b'chidot, with a vision that does not include riddles. Utmunat Hashem yabit. Somebody who can look at God. That's where the expression in the Yigdal comes from. Lokam b'Yisrael, Lokam b'Yisrael k'moshe od navi umabit et tmunato. Comes from this pasuk. Tmunat Hashem yabit. Umadu lo yiraitem ledaber be'avti Moshe. How could you not fear? How could you not be afraid to speak out against Moshe? How dare you? In the vernacular, we call this a pachin panim. We all know what a pachin panim is, right? I don't need to translate. Vayichar af Hashem bam vayelach. God got angry at them, and he went on, moved on. Ve'anan sar mi'ala ol v'nei Miriam mitzadat kashalak. Then the tent, the cloud moved away, and suddenly they found that Miriam was mitzara'at. She was smitten with tzara'at. V'yomer Aaron al Moshe, Bi Adoni al natashet al nechatat asher na'alnu v'asher chatanu. Do not place this sin or this iniquity upon us, or this foolishness that we have sinned. Al nati kamet asher betzeto melechem imo v'yachel chatzib b'saro. Do not let your sister be like a corpse, like one who's completely consumed. V'itzak Moshe al Hashem lemor al na el na defanala. Moshe cries out to God and he asks to heal her. The rest of the story is not my issue. But the Rambam picks up in this passage defines the differences between Moshe and the Navi of the likes of Aaron and Miriam, which, by extrapolation, the Rambam says, is essentially the argument of the distinction between Moshe and every other Navi in human history, past, present, or future. So there, in three psukim, we have articulated the distinctions between Moshe and other Navi. Yeah.
I'm not trying to be contrary, but in this paragraph it sounds as if Hashem's talking to Moshe, to Aaron and Miriam pretty much face to face. So you guys go out, they go out.
Look, all communication between the Navi and the individuals somehow conveys the message. It never tells us the process. In other words, the process that the Rambam is going to articulate, which describes for every other nevuah that there's a trance and there's a dream and there's images and they have to interpret the images, etc., etc. That's true for every other nevuah. It never tells us that by Yirmiyahu, Yechezkel, Yishayahu, wherever. It doesn't tell us every time God came to Yirmiyahu. It says that Yirmiyahu fell into a trance and God came to him and he saw this vision and that vision and he had to interpret it. It simply says God spoke to Yirmiyahu and told him thus. Ko amar Hashem. The assumption is that the Torah is describing a process that was germane to every nevuah, but the Torah doesn't have to go out of its way to describe the mechanism that leads to the communication for every nevuah. These are assertions, these are assumptions, that that's the way every other type of nevuah works. That's one possibility. There is another interpretation, Rashi alludes to it, and that is that at that moment God gave Aaron and Miriam a taste of what it was like to feel nevuah like Moshe. And they couldn't handle it. It destroyed them. So that's another possibility. But my intuitive sense of it is that every time God comes to the Navi, it says that God spoke to the Navi, Avraham, Yaakov, God spoke to Yaakov. It doesn't tell us in every instance that it was through a dream or that it was through riddles, but that's how we understand Nevuah to be, except for the Nevuah of Moshe. Back to the Rambam. Therefore, he says, from this story we can extrapolate four distinctions. Three explicitly articulated, the fourth implied. I'll show you what I mean. Havdel HaRishon, where it says number one, Havdel HaRishon, Shekol Navi, Eze Sheyeh, Ein Hashem Medaber Ito, Ki Im Ayudei Emtzai. Moshe, Eli Emtzai, Kamoshe Amar, Pe'el Pe'el Dabarbo. Number one, every other Nevuah is through some sort of intermediary. That intermediary can be an angel, it can be an image. It's we don't know what it means because the Rambam didn't write that 100-page treatise. But it's something that demonstrates that there's a chasm, there's a chasm between God and the Navi that has to be breached, that has to be connected through the agency of, let's call it a malach, for lack of a better term. In some instances, we know it's stated that way. In some instances, it says that the malach spoke to the Navi. In other instances, it doesn't tell us that the malach spoke to the Navi, but we know it to be so, because only by Moshe does it say, Pe el pe adaber bo. I speak to Moshe face to face. Face to face means without an intermediary. That's the Rambam's interpretation, the first level of the Rambam's interpretation of that distinction. You want to see a very interesting example of where the role of the Malach comes in. I'll show you one, and it's dafka interesting because it's about Moshe. But it's Moshe before he attains this level of Nevuah. When does Moshe attain this level of Nevuah that the Rambam is describing? Most likely through the process of the revelation at Sinai. Prior to that, Moshe spoke to God in exactly the same manner that every other Navi spoke to God. So as a paradigm, I'll show you a very interesting dialogue. Take a look at the burning bush. Shmot Perek Gimel. Who spoke to Moshe from the burning bush? Yes, that's a trick question. Who spoke to Moshe from the burning bush? No, pretend it's not a trick question. God. Right? So now take a look at the text. Perek Gimel, page 300. Moshe hayaro et tzon yitro chotno kohen midyan. Moshe was shepherding his father-in-law's flock. He brings the flock all the way up to Chorev, which is Har HaElokim, the mountain of God. He saw an angel of God in a blaze of fire amid the bush. He saw the bush burning, but the not being consumed. He's intrigued by this lack of the bush burning. When God saw that he turned to come and see, God called to him from amidst the sneh. But notice, the English doesn't do it justice, because we have three different terms used here. The first is, he saw Malach Hashem. The second is Vayar Hashem. The third is Vayomer Elav Vayikra Elav Elokim. So I got Hashem, Yikivavke, I have Elokim. I have Malach Hashem. So who's he talking to? And the answer is very simple. You understand, this is Moshe Pri Matan Torah. He's talking via a malach. Most nevuot occurred with the agency of a malach. But because the malach speaks in the name of God, it's equivalent to speaking to God. So the Navi doesn't, the Torah doesn't have to tell me every time that God spoke to a malach and told him to convey the message, and the malach came to the individual and he gave him the message, and then he understood that he was talking to God. It's a redundancy. You understand that there is some kind of agency engaged in every type of nevuah or prophetic communication. What the role of that malach is, we're not clear. But it doesn't negate the fact that there is real nevuah taking place here. It just changes the dynamic of how that communication takes place. I'll give you another example. Avraham in the Akedah. It's a very powerful example because it becomes one of the philosophical issues. The Akedah, God comes God comes to Avraham at the Akedah and he says to him, take your son, your only son who you love, and take him and bring him to Harmor, to the mountain, and there offer him as a sacrifice. When he's told to, at the last second, when he has the knife in his hand, and he's told to cease and desist, it says that a malach Hashem called to him from the heavens and told him to stop. So the question the Mefarshim ask is, God told him to do it, and a malach told him not to do it, who should he listen to? And the answer is obviously, if God says to you, you do something, and the malach comes to you and says, don't do it, you listen to God, because clearly the malach is trying to deceive you. But Avraham doesn't do that. He obeys the malach. Why? Because the whole nevuah came through the agency of a malach. Every nevuah comes through the agency of a malach. In the context of every Navi other than Moshe. You understand the distinction? That's number one. Now I understand what the Rambam says. You could write 100 pages on... Number one. Number two. V'ha'evdel ha'sheni. She'kol navi lo yavo ha'chazon ela b'zman ha'shena. Every other navi, their visions come to them when they're sleeping. As it says, b'kama mekomot b'chalom ha'layla. God came to them in the middle of the night. V'yachlom, in a dream. B'chalom ha'chazon layla. Expressions that appear throughout Tanakh. Or, alternatively, bayom, they could have prophecy by day, achar tardeimah nefelet al hanavi, but only after the navi is overcome by some kind of a trance or some kind of a momentary sleep. Umatzav shebo shoftim kol chushav umitrokenet machshavto ke'en shena, a moment or a time when he's overcome by a trance that removes all senses and leaves their mind open as in a dream to receive. And that's what is described in Yechezkel, and it says Yechezkel saw a nevuah b'mar'ot Elokim, in the visions of God. Moshe balo adibur b'yom, and Moshe, this prophecy would come to him by day, v'omed ben shnei akruvim, and he would stand in the Aron, in the Mishkan, in the Omoed, from between the Kruvim, as God promised, I will speak to you from upon the kaparet, from between the kuvim. And that's where it says in Parshas Baloscha, "Yenev yechem Hashem b'mar'e elav et vada b'chalom adab b'bolokein avdi Moshe." That's from this psukim that I read to you. Where God says to Miriam, "In every other navi, I come to them in a trance. I come to them in some sort of a dreamlike state. Moshe, awake." Standing, aware, face to face. Havdel Shlishi, number three. Shehanavi kasher ba'al ha'chazon ve'afa pishu b'mar'eh, v'ayde malach, even though we've said that comes to a dream, and even though it comes to him through some sort of agency of a malach, yachlushu kochotav umitchalchel gufo, nonetheless, it drains the Navi physically. It is physically exhausting and draining. And the Navi is overcome by this dread, as if he's going to die. And this is most directly described in Sefer Daniel, as it says, "Kishtet b'emo gaviyo b'mareh amar v'lo nish'ar b'koach v'hodi ne'apach alai l'mashchit v'lo tzad t'ikoach." He describes how he lost all strength and he fell on the floor and it overwhelmed him. Skip down two lines. U'moshe enochem. But that's not true for Moshe. Moshe would receive dibur, he would receive prophecy, and it would not affect him physically at all. That's why at the end of Chumash it says that God spoke to Moshe panim panim, and nobody, another other human being, could ever attain that. Like friends are speaking to each other. If one person is speaking to another, that person doesn't feel dread. Well, sometimes, depending on who's speaking to them. But usually, if one is speaking to another, you don't feel dread. It doesn't drain you physically. He was so connected to God by the mind that it did not affect him mentally or physically. Number four. This is the most significant in a sense. Every other prophet, the Rambam already talked about this, we saw it in the Rambam earlier, prophecy would come when God chooses. You could reach a certain level of communication, you could reach a certain level of spirituality, but you could not force the divine communication. You had to wait. Sometimes you'd wait a whole lifetime, and you'd never receive nevuah. Sometimes God would speak to you. Sometimes it would be in a communication without speech. Moshe was different. He could wait for years without prophecy. Sometimes the Navi would receive one prophecy, and that's it, for the rest of his life. And that's why they would have to prepare themselves, and they would have to purify their thoughts, and they're like Elisha. Skip down to three lines in the bottom of the next paragraph. Aval Moshe Rabbeinu kozman shiirtze amar, any time he wanted, he would receive prophecy. For example, when the daughters of Tzlafchad come to him with a shayla, what does he say? Imdu v'eshma ma'itzav Hashem lachem. Wait, well, let me go ask God. V'amar daber al Aaron achicha v'ayavo b'cholet. Even Aaron is told that he can't come into the Kodesh HaKadoshim whenever he wants. V'im Aaron b'vayavo. Aaron could not come into the Kodesh whenever he wants. Aaron could only come into the Holy of Holies once a year on Yom Kippur. Moshe could go into the Holy of Holies anytime he wanted and speak to God, because the voice came from the Kodesh HaKadoshim. So Moshe could go into the Kodesh HaKadoshim and speak to God anytime he wanted. There's a famous Rashi in Chumash on that pasuk of Imdu ve'eshma'a, stand and I'll ask God. Rashi comments, he says, Ashrei Yilod Ish, Yilod Isha. Happy is the one born of woman who has reached that level where he can say, stand here and I will speak to God and be assured that God will speak to him back. Happy is the human being. Happy is he's flesh and blood. Yilud Yisha is another way of saying he's flesh and blood. He's like you and me. But you and I can't say, give me a minute, let me ask God. Somebody once wrote as a joke, when I want to do something, I ask God. If he doesn't say no, then Moshe didn't have to worry about whether God would say yes or no. Whatever he said, speak to God. Whatever he said, he did. So these are the four distinctions. Number one, communication was direct. Pe'o pe, no intermediary. Number two, communication was awake, not in a trance, not in a dream. Number three, communication was without any physical deficiency. And number four, communication was whenever and wherever he wanted. What is the common denominator between all four? What is the shared four characteristics of Moshe's prophecy? Direct, no malach. Awake, no dream. No physical weakness whatsoever, and any time he wanted. What is the common denominator between all four of these characteristics? They are all unique, or they all describe Moshe as unique, but I'm looking for what is the common, but how are they unique? What is the character? What is the common denominator that all four of these share?
As if he's talking to another person.
Right. They all make communication with God for Moshe. Give me one word.
Human.
Close. I would have used the word natural. For Moshe, communication with God was as natural as it is for you and me to talk to each other. No ambiguity, no dream, no physical weakness, complete awareness of himself, of his surroundings, of God, of the message. There's no riddle, there's no image, there's no pictures, there's no interpretation. It's just, I communicate, God communicates with Moshe like you and I are talking here. You can't do that with any other Navi. Whatever the message, whatever the Nevuah, there always has to be some component at different levels, but some component of these four. Some component of some intermediary, some kind of trance state, some kind of dream state, some kind of vision, with images that have to be interpreted and words that have to be jumbled together, some physical draining of the sense, that you know that it's not a normal thing for a person to be in communication with God. And most importantly, you can't just say turn on and turn off every other note. Not Moshe. Moshe is as natural as two human beings talking Kapiyah. The question that I will leave you with to ponder is,
what's the question?
I got one.
Yeah.
Was this because Moshe was this special, or because Hashem needed somebody at that place at that time?
Good. So you've asked the same question, you've just given it more elaboration. That's my question. Why? Why does Moshe's level of Nevuah, why is Moshe's level of Nevuah unique? And I'll ask the question why on two levels. Why is it unique? Not how. This is all how. This is all an explanation of how it is unique. The Rambam here doesn't address the question of why. How it is unique, we now know. Why it is necessary to be so, we have to ask. And why is it so necessary? Why it's necessary may lead us to the answer to the second question, which is why is the Rambam so assured? And why is the Torah so emphatic that this is a non-repeatable process?
There is no doubt. There is no intermediary.
No doubt, no intermediary. Never be repeated. No other
because
Navi.
It is this way, there is no doubt.
Why can't anybody else reach that level? That's my second question.
Why? Why no other Navi? A third question, which we've already asked, but I it's sort of the least important, but I think ultimately it would be the answer to the other two, which is why was it necessary for the Rambam to define this as a separate principle from number six? Why couldn't the Rambam have included in number six, which is prophecy, a description of other prophets and a description of Moshe? For some reason, the Rambam felt it was necessary to split these two ideas into two separate principles. Nevuah as a concept, and the Nevuah of Moshe as a unique status. So, Rav Hashem, we have where to go from here. So we will stop here.